The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. On this edition of the show, we visit with Russell Hedrick about how he grows record yields with very few inputs. It's called regenerative farming. It's helped Russell to farm in a way far different than most of his neighbors. Learn how he's reduced herbicide costs, changed cropping systems, and incorporates animal agriculture into the revenue stream. His farming methods have him sharing his techniques with others nationally, and we learn some of his keys. It's our topic for this week's Farming the Countryside, brought to you by Pivot BioProven. It's time to rethink nitrogen. Pivot BioProven replaces nitrogen fertilizer with microbes that adhere to the crop's root system and apply nitrogen each day. 2019 performance report data shows Pivot BioProven consistently outperforms synthetic nitrogen fertilizer year over year, providing corn growers improved yields and a more dependable nitrogen supply that isn't lost to the environment. To read the performance report, go to pivotbio.com. And for more information on Pivot BioProven, just text PROVEN to 31313. I think you'll really be challenged to adopt new farming techniques by our next guest. Russell Hedrick is a relatively new farmer, as he will describe in a moment. He started small and was willing to look at his operation differently than most of his neighbors. Initially, some of those farmers may have looked skeptically at what he was doing. But now farmers nationally are asking Russell how he's accomplishing so much with so little. Here's our conversation about Russell's unique methods that have brought him success. Russell Hedrick joins me. He farms in North Carolina and does a lot of we'll say interesting things on his farm. I know his crops wind up in a lot of places and a lot of products. Russell, I appreciate the chance to visit with you. And why don't you kind of give people a quick overview of where you're located in North Carolina and what you do there on the farm?
Andrew, thanks for having me. To give you a brief overview of our operation, we farm in the foothills of North Carolina. We're about an hour above Charlotte. I was a full-time fireman. I kind of got my interest in agriculture from my grandpa, who had a few cows, and decided one day that I wanted to be a farmer too. So we started leasing farms. We started with 30 acres in 2012. By 2015, we had bought and leased enough acres for me to leave the fire department, actually start farming full-time. And really, it was a lot of luck and a lot of grace. Met a lot of great people that taught me about, you know, diversifying our operation, stacked enterprises, trying to go after those value-added products for us to see the most out of farming, trying to make money and enjoy what we do for a living.
The farm ground that you had and have was maybe some of the not greatest soil. You really had to work to kind of regenerate the soil and get things back to good shape. Is that right?
Yeah, we essentially were able to, we saved a little bit on rent. We saved a little bit on cost on the farm ground that we picked up, but it was a pretty degraded system. Resistant weeds, long-term tillage where production was starting to go downhill. And just with the regenerative farm practices that we use, we've been able to bring those farm ground, you know, back into production. And actually see them, you know, yielding a lot higher than even what some of the county average is now after being in these practices for several years.
And I know that you've really had some record crops. Regenerative means different things to different people. So what are some of the things that you've been doing there that have worked well to help not only build the soil back, but able to have some of those big yields?
You know, regenerative farming for us is really just any practice that we can utilize on the land to increase the productivity of the land and the sustainability of the land. It kind of goes hand in hand. We first started with cover crops back in 2012. Really didn't know about all the aspects of it, all the benefits, and, you know, started just looking to, you know, maybe suppress winter weeds and also stop some winter erosion. But since that time, we've integrated livestock. You know, we're strictly no-till. I had the same problems as other farmers. You know, 2018, we had a couple hurricanes and we had to harvest some wet ground. So we still get ruts like other farmers, but instead of disking a whole field, we just do those specific zones where we have problems to kind of get the land leveled back for production. And, you know, over the years, we learned about a new soil sample that came out called the Haney test that Rick Haney developed down in Temple, Texas. And it really helps us get a read on the biological activity in our soils, how nutrient mineralization happens, and, you know, being able to cut back on some of the amount of nutrients we're having to apply to the ground has been huge as far as profitability goes, just simply changing from a standard university test to using what Rick has. So, you know, looking at all these practices, they've helped the ground be more productive and helped our bottom line.
You know, I've read about your farm and some of what you've done. Talk about that a little bit more, because certainly you have built the organic matter. You've been able to do some things without putting a lot of maybe synthetic inputs into the soil. Would that be right? You've done a lot of it through maybe natural means, using livestock manures, different things like that. You already mentioned the cover crops.
Yeah, that's right. You know, when we first take over a farm, we start out using, you know, a soil sample, and they actually have a biological sample called a PLFA test that kind of tells us where the biology is at in the ground, whether it's fungal or bacterial dominant, you know, what our ratios are. And it kind of gives us a rule to try to make our production practices fit within that system to actually build the ground. And, you know, just to give a round number, after about 2 to 3 years, we've been able to cut back our synthetic fertilizer by about 70-80%. Not saying that we don't need nitrogen to grow corn just like everybody else, but most of its nitrogen either comes from organic matter breakdown or the legumes and the cover crops. They've worked out really well. And then looking at, you know, chemical reductions using those cover crops with weed suppression, we've cut our farm down to just one chemical with one spray at burn down. Sometimes we have small escapes and we'll do some spot spraying, but we really haven't had to post spray our crops for the last 6 years.
That's pretty amazing, I know, to a lot of us that would be listening to this. So is it just the work of the cover crops that's suppressing the weeds that you don't have to come back in later in the year and spray again like most people would?
A lot of the weed suppression has to do with the cover crop. It actually comes from two different ways. The first way is all that free nitrogen that we typically see in farm fields that are left bare during the wintertime, that nitrogen is left in the ground, and it's readily available for weeds. Just by planting the cover crop and growing that organic material, it's taking up those forms of nitrogen, and they're actually converting them to an organic form in the plant. So we have less nitrogen that's available for the weeds to grow early in the season. You know, we always see that spring flush of weeds when the weather, you know, kind of starts turning a little warmer. And without that nitrogen there, the weeds just, they're not able to grow as fast. They're not able to get as big of a foothold in our fields. And the other part is the physical barrier. With the cover crops growing, you know, it's actually blocking sunlight. Those cover crops actually put a chemical in the ground that has an allelopathic effect, so it stops them from even germinating. And then, you know, later in the season when we plant in our cover crops, we roll them down into a mat, and that's also another physical barrier. So there's a couple different components to it, but season-long and year-long, it does give us very good weed control.
So you're using just a roller then to kill most of that cover crop, not having to spray a burn down on it?
So our old program, when I first started farming, we had the co-op come out. They would spray. We took an old cul-de-packer, and we would roll those cover crops down and plant into them already dead and rolled. And I started learning about the benefits of leaving those cover crops as long as we could, the amount of carbon that they're sequestering from the atmosphere and putting in the ground to feed our biology. So we wanted to start planting into green cover crop standing. And I was at a farm show one day and ran into a Yetter dealer who had these stalk devastators that were meant to go in a corn header to roll corn stalks down at harvest time. And I told the guy, I was like, you know, what kind of bar do those mount on? And he told me, and I said, I want to buy, you know, a set of those. And he said, what kind of corn header do you have? And I said, they're going on a corn planter to roll cover crops. And he really looked at me like I had three heads. They didn't know if it would work or not, but essentially that bolted up to the front of the planter without any modification. So it's got a bar on the rollers that actually has a crimping effect. So if we didn't want to use chemicals at all, I would say we could get about a 85, maybe 90% kill on our cover crops. We've tried it. But to give you an idea, the one chemical we use, we use Gramoxone at burn down just to make sure that we get a complete kill on that cover crop. Do we have to? No. But I do like to see a good burn down at the beginning of the season, and that gives us a season-long weed suppression with that mat. So, it's been kind of fun to kind of see how things have evolved over the last 7, 8 years.
Oh, sure. We've talked about the cover crops. What ones are you using?
So we like to use a mix of cover crops. One of my good friends that I've made through farming, he was a soil conservationist, Lee Holcomb, kind of helped us come up with our base cover crop mix. We like to use cereal rye, triticale, and oats as three of our small grains in the mix. They have different carbon and nitrogen ratios, so they kind of break down at different times in the season. So we're spoon feeding the crop, the cash crop, whatever it may be, corn, soybeans. And that when those break down, they're actually releasing nutrients at different times. So that's kind of helping the crop plus weed suppression. And then the other part of the aspect is our legumes. I like vetch. I like winter peas and crimson clover. They produce a lot of nitrogen. They're not extremely costly to me as a farm. And then one of the other things I learned was to put a brassica in the mix. We started out with daikon radishes the first couple years, but the thing I didn't like about them is they would winter kill. I wanted something that was going to continue to scavenge sulfur and nitrogen throughout the winter time and get that big deep taproot. So we actually went to a oilseed rape. So we put about a pound of a black oilseed rape in there as well, and that's kind of our general, mix. We got a couple grasses, a couple legumes, and a brassica.
I farm in northwest Missouri, and cover crops here work, but the problem we run into is sometimes the time you get harvest done, you're pretty late in the season to be able to go back in and get something started. Is it just because you're far enough south from us, being in North Carolina, or are you doing something where you're seeding cover crops into standing crop before you harvest it? How have you found to be able to get the cover crops in a timely way?
So one of the ways we're able to do this, the second year I farmed, it was actually an idea of another farmer here in North Carolina. He said, "Well, why don't we see, what different variety of seasons can we grow of corn, soybeans?" So instead of planting a group 6 soybeans, we actually started planting all the way down to like a 4.1, with a bunch of them in between there to see how the yield would change and harvest times. And then most of my neighbors plant 118, 120 day corn. We plant all the way down to 105 day corn. And looking at these aspects, I've grown crops in a shorter length of time and not sacrifice yield. So instead of planting 120 day corn, we plant about 105 to 115 day. And that kind of spaces our harvest out enough where we've got time to start picking some of our early corn, get cover crops established, and keep corn harvest going in a timely manner. And the same thing with soybeans. We plant all the way down to a 3.8 is the earliest variety we've planted. And typically our later season beans are around a group 5. So that's still a full group below what our neighbors are. And so that lets us harvest a little quicker, gives us more time to get cover crops established. I would say one of the funnest things that I've done this season, I don't, a lot of farmers have heard about this new 60-inch corn where farmers are planting corn on 60s and growing, summer cover crops in the middle. You can also put winter cover crops in there as well, get them established earlier. So we've done some 60-inch corn trials on a couple of farms this year, and based on our ear counts, we haven't harvested yet, but based on our ear counts, we're within a bushel. So to be within a bushel of yield and to be able to, the first day that we harvest that corn, there's already a summer cover crop established and that can be grazed with our animals. That's extra money in the bank for the farm.
You mentioned the animals there. Talk about how that works into the overall farming system you've got there.
So the livestock integration, I have loved it and I have hated it. Ray Archuleta talked me into buying cows in 2013. And I went to a sale barn, bought 12 cow-calf pairs. Some of them already had their calves. Some of them they called springers. You know, I just assumed they would have their calves in the spring. What it really meant is when I left the farm to go to work at the fire department at that time, they would spring over the fence into the highway. So bringing animals onto the operation really, you know, was a learning curve. But we direct market, I would say 90% of our livestock. You know, a lot of you know, cattle farmers are having a hard time with prices, and you know, we use tools like Facebook and Twitter to really market our animals. It doesn't cost us anything, but instead of getting, you know, $1.10 a pound for a steer on the hoof, you know, sometimes we get over $5 a pound. So it really does bring into the marketing aspect, really does pay off big dividends for us to direct market our meat. And understand, you know, just like every other farmer, I have landlords that don't want animals back on their farms. So there are farms I have that don't see livestock. And then there is the time management of it. We don't run a huge 100-head herd. So, you know, it may be 2 years before all of our ground that could have livestock on it has livestock on it at some point. But just that integration of the livestock has been more profitable. It pays money in the off season when we don't have cash crops growing, and the profitability, you know, returning, you know, the manure, the herd impact, shallow incorporation of that organic matter back into the soil profile really has helped build up some of our most degraded ground.
And so right now it's just cattle and you're direct marketing like the full beef or a half and quarters. Is that how you're selling it then?
Yeah, so kind of how the livestock was integrated on our farm is we started with cattle, then we integrated Katahdin hair sheep, and then we integrated pasture pork. The one thing that I learned as a farmer about sheep is they were born to die. The wind blows and sheep fall over. So, if somebody raises sheep and they do a good job at it, they have a lot of patience. We've actually removed the sheep from our operation. And now we just do, cattle and pasture pork. And we market our beef in quarters, halves, and wholes. We have customers sign up for it. We get paid. We take it to the processor, and they pick it up. And our pork, we actually, you know, have it cut up into sausage, pork chops, bacon. You know, most of the time it's fun. I've had people call me before and want to buy a whole pig and bacon. They want their whole hog made into bacon. You know, sometimes you have to educate the general public about, you know, some of the ways farming actually works.
Well, that could be next on the list. You start growing pigs that are all bacon. That would be a good moneymaker for you.
It would be a lot more profitable, I can promise you that.
I know that on the crop side, and we could spend a whole interview on this, but talk about, are you doing some organic, non-GMO? Where are the crops winding up? Because you've got things going to distilleries and all kinds of things from what I remember.
Yeah, so when we first started farming, we were just like a typical farmer. We grew a GM crop, you know, sprayed it, fungicide, insecticided it, you know, on some of our acres. Until we really learned about, we didn't need those tools. With the regenerative system that we're in, we decided to try out non-GMO corn. I'll never forget the first year I tried to buy non-GMO seed, and my seed dealer informed me of every worm known to man that was going to destroy my crop, and it really did take some of the I guess I would say some of the confidence of my dad, who didn't even farm, just to try it out. But we went non-GMO. We haven't sacrificed any yield. We're getting a premium for our market, you know, instead of getting market price for corn. Just regular non-GMO grain, we're selling for $7.50 a bushel. And then it also opened up the markets for the distilleries. We started growing some open pollinated heirloom corn. It's yielded very well. You know, we call it liquid corn, is worth about $516 a bushel versus, you know, hard corn being worth $7.50. We try to make all the liquid corn we can. So, you know, distillery, and then we supply some other distilleries as well with their either, you know, heirloom corn or non-GMO corn. We're able to save the seed on our heirloom corn, so that essentially cuts our seed budget out almost altogether for the next year's production. So that's a huge savings per acre. And, you know, I implore, you know, different guys to try some non-GMO hybrids. I'm not saying do it on every acre, but, you know, pick out a few spots and try them out. You know, it's a savings on the seed, plus, you know, we're not sacrificing yield. And the only difference, you know, truly that I've seen on our farm is we can't spray Roundup on it. You know, if you still have a weed issue on your farm, there's still, you know, chemicals that can be used to get rid of some of the weeds that we're contending with as farmers.
So it's been, you're not doing any organic right now. It's just the non-GMO. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, we're not doing organic. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with organic, but I think organic does rely heavily on tillage, and we're not really looking to go down that route of running cultivators and doing some of the tillage aspects. There's some new technology coming out, you know, where guys are using these row mowers like Dawn came out with, and I think they're seeing some success with it, but you know, we market ours as regenerative grain, and it just simply means that, you know, we're reducing our synthetic inputs, we're reducing our chemicals. I still scout, you know, I still have jugs of fungicide in my chemical shed, just like every other farmer, and we still scout for disease and insects, and should we ever meet a threshold, we can use it, but with the practices we're using, we're just not meeting those thresholds.
You know, you've certainly had a good amount of success with what you're doing, and you mentioned about talking to other farmers to just try it out. Why don't you think more people do? Because obviously you're doing some things well and doing it right, and a lot of us are familiar with these types of things. Heck, if we're of a certain age, we probably grew up with some of this. So why do you think that there's always the big race to just cover more acres and just do that as opposed to maybe take a little more time with those acres that you've got and do some of what you're doing and looks like have good returns?
I tell you what, that is the million-dollar question I think everybody always asks me. Why don't farmers try this more? I think it really comes down to two things. I think first of all is the social aspect of it. You know, when I first started farming, being first generation, I didn't know anything about farming. I didn't have, you know, two or three or some, you know, some farmers in the U.S. four or five generations that farmed a certain way, and they don't want to try something new and it be a failure. I guess my thinking of agriculture on my farm, if I don't do one thing every year that at least fails in some way, I haven't tried. I haven't tried new things enough, or I haven't tried to push the envelope enough for the profitability of my farm if we don't see at least one thing fail. And there's some years we do some, you know, we do have things that just don't work out. It wasn't something that was meant to be, but you know, the social aspect of it is the peer pressure. You know, guys don't want to be different than their neighbors. You know, that coffee shop talk, you know, there's been plenty of it about us and our farm and what we've done. And eventually, after several years of success, we'll slowly see neighbors, you know, asking, hey, well, you know, how's that been working out for you? You know, what are you seeing? And that kind of comes around with time. The other part of it is just economical. You know, some of the farm bills and farm programs say that we have to farm a certain way, we have to do certain things. And, you know, even in my short time period of farming, we've seen some of those change as far as, you know, what RMA says, you know, guys west of the Mississippi can now plant into green cover crops where, you know, for, I don't know for how long before that time, but, you know, they had to terminate cover crops 30 or even 45 days ahead of planting. So we're seeing, you know, some of our crop insurance regulations change. We're seeing some of our farm program regulations change. I think the government's finally starting to see maybe we are starting to degrade some of these agriculture systems, and they're starting to take a look at least to let farmers try new things to see what's going to work in their area and what won't. So, you know, economically, you know, I think that we're starting to see more of a push with programs to support these conservation practices, to at least give farmers a safety net to try some of them, you know, through EQIP or CSP. And then socially, I don't think you can pick up a farming magazine in the country or listen to a farming radio station that in some way or some point doesn't talk about soil conservation or, you know, sustainability or regenerative practices. And I think that's one of the key things is, you know, we're putting the information out there for farmers to make really good informed decisions.
This is really good information, and I know that we've got to wind it up, but is there a good way for people to learn more about what you're doing and see some of that and just learn more? Where have you been kind of congregating that information, if you will?
So if people want to know what we're doing specifically on our farm, you know, I have my Facebook page. You know, they can look up my name and our Facebook page. We also have an Instagram account. You know, that's one of the new, I guess you could say, younger things for the younger generation. It's called The Regenerative Farmer. You know, just looking for a pool of information that would be really key for farmers to learn about would be the Soil Health Academy. I'm working with a company called the Soil Health Academy. You know, Ray Archuleta, Gabe Brown, Alan Williams, and you know, Shane New are the partners in Soil Health Academy. And essentially, it's regenerative farmers that have had success with doing what they do all around the country. We do three-day schools. We do private consultations. If people have questions and answers, they can call in and talk to us. But that's a really good website to go to would be the Soil Health Academy. It talks about everything from grain farming to livestock, specialty crops, marketing. We try to give all the information we can out to help farmers.
Russell, I really appreciate the time. Lots of good stuff, and I'd love to follow up and do more because there's a lot to condense into a short amount of time, but you've got a lot of good stuff going on there.
Well, like I said before, I appreciate you having me on, and hopefully it sparks some interest with the listeners, and if I can help in any way in the future, just let us know.
There's plenty in that interview with Russell to consider. He's achieving great production, and in most cases is using far fewer inputs than most operations would. Yes, there can be some hurdles for implementation, but I know I took away several ideas for our own farm as well. Remember, you can follow Farming the Countryside on Facebook, as well as our daily radio feature, American Countryside. We're posting more info to both of those sites throughout the week. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.